We now return to the online vigil that took place this past weekend for Julian Assange.
Yeah, that's right. But to open up that dossier, there's probably a lot of things in there that are not intended to be, the basis of him being there. Or maybe it's got something to do with the posts that he was assigned as well. He was given diplomatic status. He just, I don't see why that should be revealed. And even if it is, it doesn't matter. It's not. It may make it easier because it is going to violate their own constitution. A lot of people would get angry if an Ecuadorian citizen was handed over to persecutors. But they have a basic rule anyway. And the Inter-American Court said that every state that is involved in this should do their best to assure his passage, safe passage, and enjoyment, which is the actual word that is used in relation to asylum, to his destination in Ecuador. So I really don't understand why it was.
Do you know anything about the citizenship law in Ecuador? In other words, they're looking at the process that he became a citizen, whether there are any violations of that. Is there, for example, maybe he had to spend a couple of years or some time inside Ecuador to get citizenship, and he obviously didn't do that. Do you know what exactly they're looking at in terms of the citizenship law?
Well, actually, the Ecuador embassy is
territory.
Ecuador territory. Yeah. Yes. So he did spend time in Ecuador. He spent 6 years in Ecuador, technically speaking. But I was just
technically speaking.
So I was also reading Article 66 of the Ecuador Constitution. I've read it all before, but a long time ago, back in 2012, I think. But Article 66 is very interesting. So that's the right to personal well-being. So for the moment, he is still an Ecuador citizen. So he is entitled to bodily, psychological, moral and sexual safety. There's a lot of other things here, but going down to article number 6 is very significant. The right to voice one's opinion and express one's thinking freely in all its forms and manifestations.
Well, they're violating that, it seems like, aren't they?
Yeah.
Now, something else the foreign minister said that I think is curious. He said, and I'm reading from this Sputnik News report, that the issue of Assange must be settled through the direct dialogue between the whistleblower's lawyers, well, is he a whistleblower, between Assange's lawyers and the authorities of the United Kingdom. So they seem to be, in this sentence, if we can believe this, trying to remove themselves from the whole process. Like, he still has asylum and Ecuador has nothing to do with it. I mean, is that what they're saying?
Well, did they actually use the word whistleblower?
That's the Sputnik writer.
Report.
Yeah, they're not quoting him directly. They're not quoting the foreign minister directly. They're saying that he said that it's up to the Assange's lawyers and the British authorities to determine his status. What does that mean, in your opinion?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you go back, Moreno said that he will eventually have to leave. Well, in one way or another. So I guess that what he's probably saying is, the foreign minister is saying, is that that safe passage is being obstructed by British authorities. And his, because they're going to arrest him, we know why they're going to arrest him, because he needs to be in custody so that a sealed indictment can be opened, so he can be extradited without a prima facie case, so that he can be put in detention forever without trial, even under the NDAA. So there's just a whole list of things that that snowball. But the thing is, it has to be negotiated with British authorities, with his lawyers, by his lawyers. But also, one would think also with his Prime Minister and Australian diplomats, our Prime Minister could arrange that very quickly and easily. What is it? bail breach. Right. Right. So, yeah, that was while he was seeking asylum. So it is not a crime to seek asylum while you're, you know, under some kind of legal, you know, bail thing for. You can do that. That's not illegal.
We can interpret that remark then about it's up to the UK authorities and Assange's lawyers to mean that they're ready to expel him. And then it's up to the British authorities to do what they want with him in consultation with Assange's lawyers. I mean, the new foreign secretary said a couple of weeks ago that the British police would have a warm welcome for Julian Assange when he leaves the embassy. So that was a clear indication that they're going to arrest him. So the Ecuadorian foreign minister is saying, okay, it's up to the Brits to determine what they want to do with him. So that's not very, that doesn't bode very well. It doesn't sound like something to be encouraged by.
I think it was Luke Harding who said that, wasn't it? Luke Harding, the journalist?
No. That was the new foreign secretary.
Oh, was it? Oh, yeah. Right, okay. Because Luke Harding said something. Well,
he's probably said things
very
like
similar.
That,
yes,
and worse, maybe even worse. Yes. Luke Harding, yeah. And more often, most likely. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the view from Australia, since you're there. The Prime Minister, the press there, they almost disowned him as a citizen of Australia. That's what it seems like from outside.
Well, look, I don't know if you heard the interview that I did with Christine Assange on the 9th of August. But, it's a 34-minute interview, and it's so informative, and it's bloody heartbreaking as well. But, you know, she said the Australian government has done nothing for Julian. And he only received a visit from two diplomats from the Australian High Commission a couple of months ago. Jennifer Robinson, there were photographs taken, and Jennifer Robinson confirmed that was the first time he'd ever had a visit. So
ever.
There was...
Ever.
Mm. Yes, ever. But they've done so much worse than that. You know, at the time that all this stuff happened back in 2011, the Prime Minister was Julia Gillard, and Julia Gillard was a former lawyer. Now, Julia Gillard announced just after Cablegate, announced that what he had done was an illegal, irresponsible thing and an illegal thing. And 10 days later, the Australian Federal Police totally shamed her professionally by saying that he hadn't broken any laws at all.
Any Australian laws anyway, right?
Not in this country, yes. Yeah. But as it turned out, not in any country. Well, as far as we know. Since 2010, for the last 8 years. Now, also at the time, a future Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, who is our former Prime Minister, he was his former professions were barrister and then investment banker with Goldman Sachs. But when he was the barrister, he gave a lecture at the University of Sydney denouncing Julia Gillard for being a lousy lawyer and affirmed that Julian Assange had not broken any laws at all. And also, when an Australian citizen is spoken of in this way, indeed threatened in this way, and we're talking about Sarah Palin, we're talking about all of the, assassination incitements back then, an Australian Prime Minister should respond. So he was chastising Gillard for not helping Assange back in 2011, and yet when he became Prime Minister, he didn't do a bloody thing either. It's been, when I was hanging around with some activists back in, I think it was 2012 or 13, we occupied DFAT, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And it was quite an item in the news. But we really wanted some kind of assurance back then that Julian wouldn't be extradited. Otherwise, we weren't going to leave the place. And it was just, you know, it was call security and get them out and just tase them and stuff like that. And we, you know, we didn't get any answer at all. Don't think that we haven't been active in Australia, trying very hard. There's been enormous amounts that have been done by Australian activists, people like myself as filmmakers, plenty of filmmakers, plenty of people in the street, pretty full-on actions for Julian, especially over a few years, the first few years, and it's coming back now. And, you know, they just, it's like they stick their fingers in their ears and look the other way. Because, you know, their big brothers are the US and they just don't want to tread on the US's toes. It's been like that for, Jesus, since the Whitlam government in Australia, which is back in the 70s, we've had, American is very, very difficult allies, you know, because they're like your friends with the school bully, you know. You wouldn't say a word against them because they might suddenly turn on you. Although I don't think that's the case, you know. We're very, very useful. It's a two-way thing. But we have bases in Australia that are supposedly joint military facilities, like Pine Gap. And, the big stink was that our Attorney General, Lionel Murphy, back in the 70s, and he was Attorney General under Gough Whitlam, he tried to go in there, not allowed, Prime Minister not allowed in there. So it was primarily an American base, and even then the White House knew much more than what people lived
in. What would be the political cost for an Australian politician to stand up to the US, let's say just on the Julian Assange issue, to tell them back off, let alone the Pine Gap and the US bases and the Five Eyes and all of the pressure and the subordination of Australia, along with much of the rest of the world, to the U.S. Just on the Assange issue, how would the population, the voting population, react in Australia if an Australian politician stood up for Julian Assange?
Such an Australian politician has done so. So we've had Senator Scott Ludlam, and he is no longer a senator because there was this big hoo-ha about where people's grandparents were born, so they inherited a dual citizenship that they didn't even know about. And Scott was brought to Australia at a very, very young age, and he didn't know that he had dual citizenship. So, being very honest, he and another senator, a Green senator, resigned, which was a great loss. It was a great loss because he was our 21st century senator that understood all this, went to Belmarsh to be with Julian, went to Sweden to try and find out what was going on, do some deals, has spoken out. There's plenty of documentation of Scott Ludlam beautifully defended him. He's been on the vigil, Scott Ludlam. Look out for Scott Ludlam. He is the Australian politician who really stood up for Julian. And sadly, I feel that the rest of Australian politicians don't even understand the issues, are not across the, you know, the whole, probably a lot of them wouldn't even hardly know what Five Eyes are, you know, especially the regional ones. It's not, you know, people don't understand the importance of freedom of information, which I think this is. Julian's freedom of expression, because that human right is being denied. But it's essentially a freedom of information issue. We have that. That is a big issue in the world, and that's what WikiLeaks is always. And going right back to Sir Tim Berners-Lee. That's what he wanted with, you know, in giving the internet to the world, that anybody could find out anything they wanted and have a voice, you know.
So it's against the law to be a dual citizen and serve in the Senate in Australia?
Not only the Senate, but just be a member of the government or parliament at all.
And he was a British Australian citizen, is that what it was?
No, New Zealand.
New Zealand? New Zealand. Australia.
And Larissa Waters, another one, she was...
They drove him out, excuse me, they drove him out, you think, because he stood up for Assange? They made the opposition or somebody...
No,
you sure of that?
No, he resigned himself. He was informed by a barrister that his status was of as a politician was invalid. He didn't have the right to serve in politics.
When did that become an issue? After he spoke up about Assange, or it was unrelated to that?
Way, way after. It was just last year.
And you don't think it had anything to do with his
no
defense of Julian Assange, I see.
No, but I spoke to Scott, and he just after he had his farewell party, and I spoke to him, and he said that he'd seen Julian about 3 weeks before. He dropped in to say hello, but that was nothing to do with the WikiLeaks issue. But look, he had a hell of a time, in the Senate. You had Senator George Brandis, who was introducing the metadata retention bill. So, collecting our digital footprint. And Scott was, in the Senate questioning him. This guy who was organizing this, we had this fun event in Sydney called The Meaning of Metadata, because Senator Brandis didn't even know what metadata was, right? That was very embarrassing for him. So Scott, I organized that, and then Scott was the speaker. He came along. We had a lot of fun taunting Brandis, and then the morning of the event, Brandis just released the bill. He just released the law, just passed into law. And poor Scott was on television all day and didn't have time to prepare his speech. He got him back. But I spoke to Scott privately, and I'm not going to say exactly what he said, but, he was really exhausted from that struggle.
Is there any difference between the Murdoch press and the rest of the Australian media about the way they portray Julian Assange to the public?
I think there is SBS, which is our international TV station. So I've felt their reporting on Julian to be fair, and actually good information there. I found the ABC to be terrible, which is you would think that our national broadcaster would be a little bit more fair and balanced. So they're always getting into trouble from the government, which is right wing at the moment, for not being balanced and impartial. Our Prime Minister recently said, I didn't get at them for being biased. I got that the subject was about their impartiality. So it's exactly the same thing.
It's not good then. The media coverage is not good across the board.
And it's gone a bit the other way with the ABC, unfortunately, because they had an interview with Hillary Clinton. She was interviewed by a journalist called Sarah Ferguson just after her book What Happened came out. And in that interview, I think that might have been the first time where she accused the Trump campaign, the Russian state, and WikiLeaks of conspiring to interfere with the 2016 election. That all came out during that interview, and it was totally unchallenged. And there was, a lot of the things that she said, some of them were very, very mendacious. Totally mendacious. Like one of the things that she said in the interview was, why don't they ever report about Russia? Talking about WikiLeaks. And WikiLeaks have brought out over 800,000 documents about Russia. And only 1 month earlier, they had brought out a new release, the Russia spy files, which of course Hillary knew about that. But she was pretending to the innocent hobbit Australian viewer that, that WikiLeaks is you know, perennially on Russia's side. They never report about them, you know, and it was just absolutely untrue. And I don't know whether the journalist didn't even realize that it wasn't true. Probably. So incompetence, perhaps. Turning a blind eye. Oh, no, we're getting into trouble if we investigate that. We'll lose our jobs, you know.
Well, exactly. Our career.
It's 11 hours.
This is what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maintaining their careers and not rocking the boat, which is what a journalist primarily rock a boat.
It's a sad day when your national broadcaster turns into compliant media.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Without even realizing they're doing it, perhaps, through lack of research, you know, because I was a bit outraged. Nothing went challenged in that interview. No mention at all of the Podesta emails, for example. Any good that the Podesta releases had done. It was all just channeled into this destructive act, you know. But, you know, you guys must be over that now in America, you know. She didn't lose. She was robbed.
Over that? Depends of your point of view. The Democrats generally are not over that, no. I think we have Don DeBar, by the way. Kathy, thank you very much for spending half an hour with me and with our audience. And Don DeBar is next up. You are going to interview Don. Let's see if he's online yet. There he is.
There he is.
So Don can unmute his microphone. Then we'll bring him in. Hello, Don, are you there?
Hello.
Hey, Don, how are you doing? I'm going to bow out of this right now, and I'm going to turn it over to Kathy to interview Don. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye, Kathy.
Joe, catch you later on.
Okay.
Fine job, as always.
Thank you.
And Kathy, I sent you a friend request on Facebook when you get back on Facebook.
Right. So, yeah, you're one of those people that are social. That's great. So I tried to find out something about you today. I didn't have very much time, but I saw something about Radio New York. Tell us something about yourself, Don, so that I can – this is a virgin interview.
I'm a radio journalist, I guess. Every day I produce a three-hour news magazine and a 30-minute newscast. So Monday through Friday, the newscast airs on terrestrial radio, about maybe 50 stations around the U.S., The news magazine airs mostly on internet, outlets. It's through a group we set up, a bunch of ex-Pacifica producers called Community Public Radio. Our website is communitypublicradio.org. And so we have a group of producers in L.A., for example, that used to be at KPFK Radio that are running an internet station there. And it has an audience comparable to the terrestrial radio station, KPFK. I have a group in New York and D.C., ex-producers from WPFW, WBAI, Pacifica, and scattered around the country, some others. And then a lot of terrestrial radio stations carry the newscast. I'd say most notably KGNU in Denver, Colorado, for example. So that's what I do days. And I do political commentary for RT and Press TV and some others, struggle wherever else I think I can put my back into something where, you know, it looks useful.
Yeah. Maybe starting with what's just happening at the moment, maybe to continue the conversation that I started with Joe, what's your feelings on what's been happening in Ecuador in the last couple of days?
Yeah. I saw the, a piece at Sputnik about what had happened in the legislature there. And I agree that it seems likely that Lenny Moreno's dirty hand is on this in the back room somewhat. He can't be, he's been over solicitous to the United States since he took office. Now, he got elected because he had Rafael Correa's arms around him. He was supposed to be, you know, he was the heir apparent. He was supposed to continue down that road. the road, you know, the critical road in Latin America and the Caribbean has been, you know, sort of the Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez route, you know, Bolivarian route, independence, sovereignty, you know, mutual support in those efforts. You know, the U.S. being the antagonist since Monroe Doctrine in the early 19th century. You know, as soon as he gets in, he does a complete reversal on that and, you know, is trying to be almost outdo Macri in Argentina, who, when he got elected, one of the first things he did was write a, you know, $12 billion check to the, what do they call them, vulture funds, over some claim that they had against Argentina that no court or anyone else outside the United States recognized at all. It was liquidated in, you know, the dissolved in the financial problems of Argentina, you know, in the early part of the century. So, you know, when you see Lenny Moreno wanting to kiss the collective behind of Washington and Wall Street, and he sits on the fate of Julian Assange, and then suddenly, you know, sui sponte, some, you know, rumbling start in the legislature to get Julian Assange out of the embassy. Well, you know, it's really not even subtle.
It's not subtle at all. Yeah. So, but do you think he was some kind of sleeper cell, or he had a change of heart?
Oh, and I don't know. The check cleared the bank. I don't know. You know, we can only speculate. But what we do, we know what he's done, however. His motivation, yeah. You know, look, imputing motive is always a fool's errand. We can never know. People themselves don't often know, you know, completely why they do things. And you know, guessing why he's doing it, somehow that may be useful. But I think the most useful thing is we know what he's doing and we got to stop it. And so, you know, money's got to go. That's basically, I mean, it's for the people of Ecuador to decide, of course. But I think he's demonstrating to them on a daily basis that that's a fact. And they're going to have to figure out how to do it. The rest of us, you know, what we can do is what we've always done. Stand by, you know, in solidarity. Something we can do to help? Okay, fine. You know, and that's it.
Maybe he needs his government to vote against handing him over. Maybe he needs the people's support. Because I have a feeling that that $1.1 billion deal, the oil deal, has a lot to do with this. Sweetens it. So he can't be seen to have welched on the deal if the people vote against it, right? If there's such a big reaction that he can't actually do that because it's against the law as well. I mean,
there's so much. It's so complex, too. You've got, you know, all the cleanup that had to be done and has to be done still there from, who was it, Shell was the big polluter there. A couple of the American and British and European petroleum companies, you know, devastated Ecuador like they've done all over the planet, really. You know, rape, pillage, and, you know, consume monster that walks the earth and, you know, thundering footsteps. So, you know, and the people there, there've been court cases, there's been, you know, rebellions, all kinds of activity around this for many years. It's a tough read for the rest of us, how people will vote on a particular, you know, question that's put to them, because the context is so large. And yes. I don't have my finger on the pulse of the Ecuadorian population, like, say, Gallup or Gannett or whatever the local subsidiary is. And so, you know, I can't say what would be the best way forward because I can't predict what the outcome would be. And then given that, you know, so let's say the people decide against him and this track follows, you know, of activity, of behavior, of, you know, institutional behavior. Well, where does that go? Well, I don't know. We don't know where it's headed. So what's the outcome going to be ultimately, good, bad, or indifferent? It's very complex, you know, beyond my ability to predict. You know, what we can do is let people decide what they want to do themselves and support them and protect them from our government's interference. I mean, to me, my biggest job in terms of interfering in other countries is to keep my government the hell out of there. If I can do that, I'm doing them a favor, no matter what.
You'd be doing the whole world a favor, would you?
Okay. So,
multiple purpose. All right. So what do you think that what do you think would need to happen so that we at least get it back to the point where he is not in solitary confinement anymore?
Julian, well, you know, I saw also at Sputnik and at your Facebook page, a reference to it, the, you know, there was this attempt by, essentially by the last Ecuadorian deputy foreign minister to sort of deputize Julian as, you know, an agent of the foreign ministry of Ecuador. To, you know, empower him to go visit the Russian embassy as a deputy minister of Ecuador. So he would have diplomatic immunity and could travel from the Ecuadorian embassy to the Russian embassy and then presumably, you know, wherever after that. Even if he's just going to the Russian embassy, I assume it's a larger headquarters than you know, it's a bigger country. I assume they have a bigger flat in London, whatever. But the British government shot that down and basically said, look, set foot outside, we're snagging you. So, you know, I don't think there's that kind of appetite in Lenny Moreno's government anyway to, you know, provide opportunities like that for Julian. But clearly there's, an antagonism that's, you know, operating as policy from the British government that's going to have to be factored somehow. And I think, you know, if you look at it strategically, there needs to be some lever against the British government, you know, executing against Julian in whatever can be arranged for him, which means organizing tactically, means organizing some powerful forces in London where all of this would actually physically happen. You know, even if you're organizing 10,000 people to surround him so he can walk into the middle of a crowd. The crowd walks to the Russian embassy or Heathrow or wherever, and he gets the hell out of there. I don't know how you'd organize that, you know, and I'm not advocating that someone organize that in case that's illegal, but gee, I think the outcome of that would be one way he would, you know, be liberated. So maybe people might want to investigate that as a possibility.
Well, you're not the first person to say that, because Cynthia McKinney said that as well. Mm-hmm. And she said that if that was happening, she would be there.
Yeah,
she would go.
I know she would too. She'd be calling me from another jail, like she called me from the jail in Rafah last time when she got arrested by the Israelis.
Oh, haven't we all almost had that happen to us?
Yeah. You know, I keep listening for rumblings in the driveway. You never know.
Yeah, so Cynthia's on later on. Cynthia's coming on the vigil tonight.
Oh, good. Very good.
Tonight.
Yeah,
she'll be on later.
Yeah.
But go ahead. Go ahead with what you were going to say.
No. This morning, today, tonight is so difficult when we're doing something like this where it's global. This is true. This is a remarkable project. I got to hand it to Susie and to all the folks that are involved in this. Joe, you, everyone that's involved. This is an amazing project. Every month now, journalists all over the world, you know, discussing this, helping to organize some, you know, something to get Julian his liberty and to protect the rest of us, you know, help each other protect the rest of us from that kind of abuse by governments. I think it's a remarkable thing, and I'm really happy and honored to be able to participate in it.
So how long have you been a supporter of WikiLeaks? So pardon?
Since I first heard of it, you know, shortly after, you know, public. Mm. You know, here's a bunch of, you know, a trove of documents that have been, you know, taken from the U.S. government that are being released. Really? You know, that they won me over that day. He said, oh, great. You know, it's like you got somebody like, the janitor or somebody at the Pentagon has a key to the back door. And at night they, you know, walk in, go into the file room, grab a box of files, run out with them, set up an office somewhere, stick the box on a conference table, and then send out a message. Hey, folks, I got a box of documents out of the Pentagon. Come look through it. I think it's fantastic. You know, what happened with the Vietnam War, the main way people found out the truth to that was somebody did pretty much that in an FBI office, and they found out what was really going on. You know, the back channel conversation about that. And it was a completely different story from what every newspaper, TV station, radio station, talking head, politician, priest, rabbi, shaman, everyone in, you know, all the official dumb language that they were discussing this thing in, completely different from what the FBI and the Pentagon and everybody were discussing among themselves. And as soon as that got out, boom, there were people in the streets. And so this is a global version of that. And given the nature of information and information management in this period, as opposed to the 60s, where you physically had to put your hands on something to look at it, now, you know, just shoot electrons over, not even wire, over the fiberglass or whatever, or through the air, it's like to the nth power, that kind of power to look behind the curtain at what's really happening. I think things are much worse than they were 50 years ago. And so it's much more urgent that we have the ability to do this. But thankfully we do. And we've got people like Julian and others that are willing to put their neck on the line to make sure that that happens. And so, you know, I think that's been my feeling about WikiLeaks since the first day I heard of WikiLeaks.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been thinking since Kristen Hrafnsson was handed the position of editor-in-chief, the continued persecution of Julian is somewhat pointless in a way, because it's not going to stop the organization. It really shows that there will probably always be a WikiLeaks. God help us if there isn't.
Well, I hope that that's true. You know, and what's said is you cut down one and 1,000 will stand in their place. You know, whatever version of that you're familiar with. But, you know, the bad guys have a perception and some history to validate it, that if they go in and, say, grab Julian and chop off his head in a public square, it's going to chill an awful lot of those 1,000. That they're going to say, well, maybe we can find another way of doing this struggle, and they quietly exit stage left. The fact that it appears that he's almost superfluous now because other people are running the show, I don't know that they necessarily see it that way. Historically, that's not how they see it. I would have a plan B, like namely rescuing him somehow.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's, yeah, because the whole purpose of the Unity for J movement is to not let it get to that. Yep. We've been talking about a doomsday clock for Julian, where midnight is where he gets kicked out of the embassy. Yep. And we saw it move forward again a few days ago. But there have been moments when it has been moved back as well.
Right.
Because of the actions of people like us and, you know, outperforming the mainstream media, I've heard, because we are so... Yeah. So numerous and so on it, on top of it. And because, well, the media has been handed over to the people, so it's just up to us to shout out spread the word. Yeah, absolutely.
See, also, I mean, it's not a zero-sum game for Julian and for us with respect to Julian. You know, it's one thing, first we have to protect him from letting that clock strike 12, whatever, they cart him off to prison or, you know, some horrible fate like that. Another, though, is while he's tied up in the embassy, and this is definitely not lost on the bad guys, what he was doing prior to his having to run to the embassy, he can't do. He's done an awful lot from considering his situation. He did the TV program with RT. He's done a lot of public work. But you know, he's under a severe disadvantage. You know, God knows what he'd be doing if he were at liberty.
Yeah.
And the bad guys are afraid of what he'd be doing, and that's why he's not at liberty. And so, you know, just because we're maintaining the status quo at 5 to 12 or whatever, doesn't mean we've – I mean, look, I don't mean we should run ourselves down over it, but – You know, let's liberate him and put him back to work. We're a lot better off if we can do that. And the other side of the point is, if he's stuck there forever, what's he, 60, in his 60s, late 50s, in his 60s, something, he's like my age, a little younger than me. You know, who wants to spend the end of their life in, you know, in a closet in an embassy somewhere, as opposed to, you know, being able to bounce around the world? And he's done an awful lot of good work, maybe get some recognition, not, you know, awards and trophies, but people every once in a while going, thank you, man. Keep it up. You know, he doesn't even get to do that. He's got to look out the window and see if there's a paddy wagon outside. That's about what he gets to do during the course of a day.
That's true.
Put it in a
simple language. Well, I mean, I've always thought that, you know, people, Julian was always at his most powerful when nobody knew where he was.
mean, you know.
That's what they're afraid of. And when he used to come into the Frontline Club, you know, on the screen and from an unspecified location, because his point of entry into the net could be anywhere, and you know, such a master of disguise, and But you know, the other thing is that it must be very, very hard to accept not having full control over the narrative anymore. WikiLeaks, this amazing journalism, more scoops than the rest of the mainstream media combined. I was saying last time, too much too soon, and it's just like, you know, it becomes very unpredictable for so many people, and they don't like that. Just the unpredictability of what WikiLeaks will discover, who will send things to WikiLeaks, because they're not active, they're passive.
That's right. Here it is. Like I said, they just put it on the table in the conference room and hang a sign outside. The file box is in. That's basically it. And then people go do what they do with it, you know. Some people use a piece of paper to light a cigar with or whatever. You know, others are going to figure out how to, you know, make a new Wankel rotary engine. You know, somebody else is going to fly something to Mars or whatever. Somebody else is going to take down the U.S. government. Hopefully.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean,
do what they will with it. That's my point. Yeah.
That's right. But it was an Australian journalist, TV presenter, said that the genius of WikiLeaks is that, you know, it kind of is a deterrent to doing the wrong thing, because you know that anybody in your, or having a safe Dropbox, anybody in your organization could be the one that brings you down.
Yeah. Piece of paper might end up on WikiLeaks website. And do you want the world to see that?
Yep. Yes. And theoretically, therefore, people should behave better when they know that this could be, you know, in the news very easily. And it could be the guy next door in the next office could have actually been, you know, raise some moral objection. And, you know, people who work, I know someone who works in Home Affairs, and I can't name names or anything, but, you know, he is morally outraged probably at least two or three times a week by what happens, what's part of his job. But, you know, he's going to jail if he says anything. We have a world where, you know, WikiLeaks appears, people can theoretically denounce the crimes, and then at the same time there arises the fear of the insider threat, cameras everywhere, surveillance on government employees, keystrokes recorded, everything to prevent the truth from getting out. So there's a bit of a war on both sides, really, isn't there?
Yep. Yeah, it's what you're describing is basically an end to impunity for some people, at least a theoretical end to it. They have to consider, perhaps I don't have impunity, you know, perhaps somebody's going to blow the whistle on me. And, you know, that's a bad thing for me if I'm doing really bad stuff. And we know there are people doing really bad stuff.
Well, that's right. John Pilcher said that, you know, when you combine secrecy with impunity, that's when bad things happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, impunity thrives in secrecy. You need it.
Mm. You know?
I mean, people like to do things that, you know, be notorious when they're doing them, but you really need, you know, secrecy is like fertilizer for the kind of things that impunity protects and shields, you know. So I think that one of the things that we have to keep, you know, in the forefront is looking at the response to things that have happened already with this crack in their official narrative, the, you know, Brexit, Trump, you know, all these different plebiscites in different places that didn't turn out the way they were supposed to. You know, there are many complexities to these things, but you can see that the response from power is strictly over their loss of control of the narrative, the instruction set narrative. In other words, this is what's going to happen next, and people turn around and say, no, it ain't, and they do something else. That really, I mean, look at the insane reaction of the media in the U.S. to the 2016 election. You know, the Russians somehow with, you know, $80 and a couple of, you know, deposit bottles to be returned, were able to make a strategic media buys in Facebook and turn around the entire Western media narrative, the $2 billion budget, all kinds of other stuff, and put Trump in the White House. Same about Brexit. They said the same thing about Brexit, you know, and a number of other, you know, elections, referenda, you know, whatever around the world. They are furious. Mm. They're scared, really. That's what's driving it.
Yeah. So, you know, he's been asked to testify, Assange. How do you think that will pan out in relation to, do you think that will find some resolution, like it, if the location, because it wasn't very clear whether Assange was requested to come to the United States, but it was kind of saying that it was, well, WikiLeaks said that they were seriously considering the possibility as long as Assange's safety was guaranteed. That sort of has been dropped a little bit. That's disappeared from the news. Do you know anything about that? Because that's happening in your country.
No, I haven't followed, seen any updates of it. and I didn't really understand it when I saw the reports you're referring to. I understood the reports, but it didn't make any sense to me. You know, you have a number of elements here. One, the enabling case that had him, you know, have to seek refuge in the embassy, you know, from Sweden, right? Mm. I believe that that's closed. That's gone away, right? There's a no prosecution from there. The witnesses have pretty much recanted, and I believe that's the status of the last time I looked. And there's no official indictment in the U.S. that I'm aware of for, you know, being a whistleblower. You know, I don't know what they could be talking about with him if it's not those two cases. They want to have him over for tea? You know, I don't know. So when I was looking at them talking about interviewing him, I was thinking to myself, about what? And I didn't know the answer to that, really, and I still don't. So,
well, I mean, I had the impression that it was in relation to the Mueller inquiry, you know, that there was some evidence that he could give there about also, we're all speculating, aren't we? But isn't it the House Intelligence Committee that wants to hear what he has to say? But we're not even sure about what, that's right.
Right, don't know. I don't know. But I don't know what
any, yeah. It's gonna be a bit quiet. That.
There's the, you know, the whole Russiagate thing. There is that.
So. It's the Russiagate thing, yes. So, you know, the last time when I was talking to interviewing Christine, his mother, there was that theory that, you know, if he went, maybe Trump wants him to testify because he might provide evidence that Trump had nothing to do with any kind of collusion, you know, and Christine said, well, who knows? President Trump can change his mind every day. So let's hope it's on a good day. But it's been quite a while now. It's been 2 months, and that hasn't progressed. We haven't had any news at all. It was at the beginning of August where that subpoena came out.
Julian's role in that case would be, you know, to present exculpatory evidence that, you know, Trump did not have contact with Russia over these things, and nor did he, that I act as an intermediary for that, because I didn't get him from Russia, because I got him from him. Mm. He's already said, and they've already said, we're not going to divulge our source. Now, I know they've suggested maybe, you know, some intermediate step, or maybe the source itself is going to say I was the source, and then, you know, WikiLeaks confirms it. That might be a way of doing it, and then that would be exculpatory evidence for Trump's people. In other words, Russians had nothing to do with what Trump ended up with. It came from Bob over here that gave it to Julian, and WikiLeaks who gave it to Trump or published it or whatever. So, you know, I mean, maybe something on the order of that would be what they're talking about doing, but, you know, I don't know. If it's Seth Rich, for example, that was the source, he's dead. You know, so I don't think he's going to come back and say, I now give you permission. So, you know, maybe people feel comfortable with the idea that something I give you in confidence, you know, the confidence is till death do us part. And after that, you're relieved of, you know, confidentiality obligation. That may be what they're thinking too. And I don't know, that may well be a reasonable approach to the problem. I don't really know. I haven't given it much thought.
Well, in that case, I'm surprised that they're not indicting or asking for testimony from Craig Murray, because Craig Murray went over there to pick up the material and brought it back over. He's already written about that. He you know, Craig Murray's a former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, and you know, great writer and great activist now as well, but and whistleblower as well. Famous whistleblower. So Craig has already said that he was the intermediary.
Right. So there you go. So that worked. You know. Yeah.
They ignored it. Yeah. I know that doesn't fit. That doesn't fit into the narrative. But you know, Craig Murray could be questioned, possibly even in Julian's place. I don't see why not.
Yeah, there's that too. If, let's say, someone showed up, you know, for the whole Russian narrative, said, you know what, it wasn't Russia, it was us, you know, whoever that might be, little green men, you know, South Pago, I don't know, whatever. And here's a trove of evidence, you know, documenting that. They're too invested in the Russia narrative to let it go. You know, nuke South Pago, you know, whatever. Hide the little green men in Nevada or something, and not tell us, because they're so heavily invested in it. So I don't know. Yeah.
I'm not sure if Mark is here yet.
Yeah, I can't tell.
I think he's on the way in. I got a message to say that he hadn't arrived yet, and we should just keep going.
So I'm asking, what, you know, so I don't know. I guess he'll pop up in one of these little windows.
I'm here.
Sorry to come in.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Don. How are you?
Good. I don't see your camera, though. You look like a girl in a green dress.
you're too kind. Let's see. What do I have to do here to be visible?
I don't know. That's easy. That's like her. Looks like a portrait, like from a professional photographer. White background and everything, you know.
There should be some kind of an icon that I'm supposed to.
You got to reboot and come back in.
Oh, I do?
That's what Susie just told us. We've had this issue before.
Okay.
So close the window and then log back in. That's
okay, will do.
And if you have your Skype open, close it. So there. Anyway, how do I do this? I'm going to put you back here. No. Kathy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yeah.
Oh, there you are. Okay. I was going to say we need your picture back up instead of, I guess that's Susie. I don't know. It was a photograph.
That is Susie.
It was there, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, and the green dress. That's Susie. Yeah. I was trying to, of course her dress is green, but yeah, I thought you knew Susie. So I'm thinking, is he saying that Mark has an image of himself in a green dress? No. That you shouldn't be saying that in public. That's kinky. Sorry, I'm just eating some chocolate. It's been sitting in front of me and I've just been dying to have some, but you know.
Mark, he needs to reboot his computer. Okay, sorry. I gave him bad information. Okay, I get it. That's why I remember. In fact, we worked that out when we were playing with this once.
Well, this is going to take a while then. All right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, man.
All right. Okay.
Do a little dance and whatnot. Hey, I wonder if I can play. No, never mind. Anyway, what do you do? Well, and where are you? You're in Sydney?
Yeah, I'm a lecturer in film, and I teach visual effects and animation, and I'm a hobbyist journalist as well. So I've have had my blog for about 8 years now, thingtothing.com. So it's, so much to do with WikiLeaks and whistleblowing and matters of national security, Five Eyes. That's my hobby horse.
So you work with John Pilger you're an amateur journalist and you get to work with somebody like John. Damn. He's great.
Well, so I made the WikiLeaks tapes. It's a series of films about WikiLeaks.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah. And you've got Ellsberg and Chomsky. I couldn't do the Zoom thing. I had to go there. And John Pilcher was in the WikiLeaks tapes. And I've known John since then. That was the first time I ever spoke to him. He can feel very prickly at first, but he's a great man. So he comes back to Australia quite often and I organise stuff, events that he speaks at. I also run a weekly event, or help run it, I'm digital producer of a weekly event called Politics in the Pub. And so we did a live to air event for Julian Assange called The Gagging of Julian Assange on August 9th. And we had as our guests Christine Assange and Susie Dawson.
Cool.
I filmed John Pilger in Sydney, talking in Sydney. He asked me to. So we had forewarning. So in fact, I made it a Politics in the Pub thing. We had two cameras. And so we went and did it well. We filmed Pilger well. And, so the sound was really good and everything. And that monumental speech that he gave to beg our Australian Prime Minister to just go, make a call and, 15-minute call, do the deal, turn the, sort the bail breach thing out. It's normally a small fine, according to Greg Barnes. Mm. Especially the charges that it's, the cases, the investigation, the questions have been done, case is dropped. Right. And this is just in relation to an Interpol arrest warrant. For what? There's no case left. And it's just so irregular that's still hanging around. So John Pilger comes to Australia quite often, and John Pilger was going to be on this vigil, except he's filming this weekend. So he's going to be on the next vigil.
Good.
Hopefully. Yeah. So I did say to Susie, I could pre-record him, although he doesn't like to come in via Zoom. It might just be a phone thing, like with Christine. Because both of them, they have to suit Christine, especially as well. Thank you.
Thank you.